Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game. Me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, it's the start of a new week, which is probably for the best because last week was a little bit hectic, wasn't it?
Yes. By Friday, I was completely lost and confused. Yeah. I went to the student ball on Friday night. Oh, yeah. Then had to catch the 5 o'clock train from Liverpool to London on Saturday morning. So that wasn't good. And then, of course, they cancelled the train.
Oh, cool.
Were
you invited to the student ball? Or you just turned up.
We was invited. Yeah. We're to pay, and rightly so. But it was good. The trouble is, I've been teaching them sort of 6 or 7 hours beforehand, and then of course everybody's scrubbed up. And I go, well, there's nobody in hoodies. I don't recognise a soul.
Kieran, you're nurturing these young souls. They shouldn't be making you pay to go to their ball. It's an outrage.
Oh, it's an honour to be invited anywhere.
That's
at my age. Yeah. So I take it.
Now, have you recovered from your satisfaction at being mentioned in the House of Commons on Thursday?
It was a bit surreal because I've never heard of the MP.
Oh, really?
okay. That's very kind. Yeah. So I'm officially in Hansard, yes. As is the Price of Football podcast. It's a communal honour, dead chuffed, and I've even mentioned 3 times in the white paper. Which are going, do they know? I'm the person that put the phrase Arkansas Chuggabug into the Vis Profanosaurus, because if they did, I suspect my name would have been struck off.
My favourite bit about the mention in the House of Commons was somebody who sent me a link to Parliament TV or Parliament Today or whatever it's called, and said it's 7 hours 35 minutes in. All right, okay, I'll make a note of that. It's Questions Day, Kieran, and our first question is a good old fashioned, straightforward, on the nose, simple one for you about one of our old favourites. And it comes from Tim Derbyshire, which is pleasing, really, because it's about Derby County. Tim Derbyshire says, do we know exactly what happened with Derby County's HMRC debt? Did HMRC accept less than 100% in the end?
Well, yes, they did, because I think we'd said at the time, given that HMRC effectively have new powers and new rights, which they've been fighting for many years, if they accepted less than 100%, it would effectively set a benchmark going forwards in respect of other clubs. But in the end, they accepted 25%. So they were, I think they owed £26.3 million and they ended up taking just over six. So the taxpayer took a hit for over £20 million. And I do think there was a bit of gaming taking place here. And as always, you know, we say separate the football club from the owners. You know, the owners, in my view, when COVID hit, the Chancellor at the time, who was in fact Rishi Sunak, he did relax the rules in terms of outstanding tax owing. He said, "Yeah, I'll give you time to pay." Time to pay is not the same as not paying. Derby County did run up some quite considerable tax debts, you know, and remember they were deducting PAYE from the salaries of staff and not handing it across, and they were selling goods and services, collecting the VAT and not handing it across, and then the EFL said to its members, you know, at the time we were all in fear of losing football clubs. The EFL got an arrangement with the Premier League where the Premier League would underwrite some loans which the EFL could take out. The Premier League would pay the interest, then the clubs could borrow from the EFL. And the sums involved, because the EFL have just published their accounts, the sums involved are quite significant. By all accounts, Mel Morris refused to take out one of those loans. So what his motivations were during that period of time, because from speaking to other people connected to other clubs who did take out loans and have had to repay those loans to the EFL. I think it's fair to say that they're unhappy because they played by the rules, and Mel Morris said, no, I've got bored of football. And I mean, you know, it cost him a lot of money. I'm not denying that, but he got bored, put the club into administration, and the tax authorities have lost £20 million as a result of that. So sadly, Tim, HMRC, and I think they probably did the right thing, because ultimately we want a Derby County. And if HMRC had played hardball, the administrators wouldn't have been able to sell the club and satisfy all of the EFL rules. And therefore, potentially the club would have gone into liquidation. And therefore, going forwards, HMRC wouldn't be picking up VAT or PAYE from the new company under David Clowes. And you know, the more I hear about David Clowes, the more impressed I am. He does seem a pretty honourable man from people that I've spoken to, not only around the club, but in the world of football itself.
Oh, well, that's good news for Derby County fans listening, Kieran. For Southend United fans listening, who Wednesday, the 1st of March, is the day when the winding up order is due to take place, unless Ron Martin pays what he owes HMRC. Can Southend offer a deal to HMRC now, or do HMRC only do deals if the club goes into administration?
There's always a deal on the table. HMRC are pragmatic. They've also got completely fed up with Ron Martin, who has... He's not just done it since we started this podcast. You know, Southend have appeared far too often on this show, especially over the course of the last 12 months. But talking to people, and you know, Matt Slater, who's been on this show, Matt writes for The Athletic. He's an absolutely devout Southend United fan. You know, he's written a fantastic article sort of summarising Ron Martin's activities. He could come up with an instalment plan.
Right.
And HMRC said, yeah, okay. But this is supposed to be the final warning. But as anybody that's ever tried to get their kids to go to bed knows, that final warnings, there's always another potential, because it's actually quite difficult to put your kids up on eBay if they fail to go to bed, as has been my experience. The one thing that we know about Ron Martin is that he does like playing brinkmanship with the tax authorities. Looking at some of the reports, and this is where I think some of the local journalists, and I think we've got Chris Philpott, or at Southend, and I know the guy that used to do the Berry story, these guys who are football journalists had to become legal experts and accounting experts and so on, but they've kept the fans informed, and it doesn't look great because it's not just the £1.4 million which is owed to HMRC. There are still people who have not been paid their January wages by Ron Martin, and you just feel increasingly uneasy about what's going to happen on Wednesday.
Yeah. Before we go on, Kieran, I should probably explain to listeners who will have noticed that I sound a bit bunged up at the moment. I'm only a pub doctor, but I suspect it's because it was so cold on the way to Selhurst Park on Saturday night that I actually bought a bobble hat, which I won't be doing again because the response was less than enthusiastic from those around me. And of course, as somebody pointed out, if we'd won, I'd have to wear it to every game. But
exactly.
I think what happened is that the bobble hat, I had pulled the bobble hat down so my ears were warm, but my nose was cold. So I think that might have done something to my sinuses. I'm not an expert, don't quote me on this, but that's the reason why I'm a bit bunged up. Phil Chater has our next question, and it's, okay, this is right up your strata. Phil Chater says, when football clubs talk about building a new home, they often talk about being able to generate new income, as the stadium will be used more than just on match days. With this in mind, Rotherham United have been in their new, if we can still call it new, stadium since 2012. Given 10 years of records then, is there a way, brackets Kieran's spreadsheet library, you can compare the previous 10 years at Millwall to the years at the New York Stadium and discern the differences and what they are? In other words, has it worked and made more money for them?
Right, Phil. Sadly, when Rotherham were playing at Millmore, for the majority of the time there, they were what is classified as a small company. And a small company doesn't publish an income statement, and therefore it doesn't have a revenue breakdown or a wages breakdown. So it's not for the want of trying, because I suspect I was possibly the only person whilst the Carabao Cup was taking place who was on Company's House records trying to find Rotherham United's accounts from 15 years ago. And I did find them, to be fair. I did find them, but the quantum of information that would be able to answer that question properly wasn't available. In terms of the New York Stadium, Rotherham do generate commercial income of, in a very good year, they'll make £5 million. Now, yeah, part of that will be sponsorship. I think they do have some connections with the owners in terms of some of their sponsor and commercial income. I'd also like to say, from my observations, they are one of the more transparent clubs in terms of what they do put out. So fair play to them. You know, I've noticed in the last few years they are certainly putting out information which they hadn't done historically. If fans want to use it, yeah, fans want to get a feeling for it, because for me, a fan is an important stakeholder of the club. And those words have been echoed by the white paper.
Indeed.
By the way, that's great. And carry on with the good work at Rotherham. So from what I can see, they are moving in the right direction in terms of the amount of commercial income which is being generated on a regular basis since the move to the new stadium. Having said that, the biggest difference in terms of revenue is the difference between the broadcast income in League One and the broadcast income in the Championship. And certainly from what I'm seeing and hearing, sort of following, again, going back to the white paper, is that a lot of people seem to be coming up with solutions between the Premier League and the Championship, which is fine.
Yeah.
But it seems to be the case of creating Premier League 2. So having Premier League 1 and 2 in all but name. And if you are in Leagues 1 or 2, tough. And that's the thing which is making me quite twitchy. I mean, I was on Five Live with Mark Palios of Tranmere. We're doing some stuff, talking to Adrian Charles, and it was quite clear that Mark doesn't feel particularly happy with some of the proposals. Uh-huh. Because if we're going to solve issues of distribution in revenue in football. And I'm not looking for a Cuban-style socialist utopia or anything like that. Manchester United and Liverpool deserve to generate more money because they have a global interest, and I think that must always be remembered. And they generate eyeballs, which can then help the clubs lower down. But at the same time, we mustn't just have a model which solely addresses issues in the Championship, whilst weakening the Premier League and weakening Leagues 1 and 2 at the same time. So, listening to some of the comments coming out has been intriguing. I think it's fair to say that the libertarian wing of the Conservative Party, in my view, haven't covered themselves with glory. They appear to be the patsies of the Premier League in trying to make accusations that, as far as I'm aware, are pretty flimsy. This is not going to be a government body. I don't think it's going to have 200 employees either. I don't know where some of these scare stories are coming from. And yeah, I'm a great believer in light touch regulation, nudging rather than forcing people to do things, and also just disincentivizing bad behavior tends to mean that you don't need a lot of regulation on a day-to-day basis, because the wrong-uns have effectively been encouraged to go elsewhere with their obnoxious behavior.
Yeah, we all know you like a nudge, Kieran. It might be interesting to ask Mark Palios to come on the show then, because I think certainly our conversations about the white paper and the independent regulator and our interview with Tracy Crouch, which went out on Friday, reflected what we consider to be an overall positive response. So if there are people in the game at that level that have reservations, it would be interesting to hear what they were. Two things on the Rotherham thing, okay, and that £5 million figure, how does that compare commercial income-wise with other clubs in League One? I mean, I would guess Sheffield Wednesday, for example, would be higher, but how does it compare to similar-sized clubs?
It's very good. Right. Some clubs will have total income of $5 million. Let alone total commercial income. So yeah, I think I don't know. If people have been to the New York Stadium, I've been to there and to Millmore. They are substantially different. It is geared towards being a bit more multifunction, and I think that's to the credit of the people involved. I've also got to say, it's one of those grounds where you are made incredibly welcome. Yeah, when you go into and some stewards and they start having a chat with you. How long did it take you to get here? And are you having a good season? And just sort of, I've absolutely enjoyed my time going there. Apart from they're one of those sides which always seem to have the golden sign over us. I've never had a decent result here whenever I've been there.
You're talking about the stewards showing that sort of normal sociable behaviour that gets us Londoners really suspicious. What are they after? What are they trying to distract me from? What's going on? What are they keeping me talking? And this, you mentioned the small company. Is that unofficial? Is there an official classification of size of company, or is it just go, that's clearly a small company?
No. It is set out in statute in the Companies Act.
Is it?
It's less than 50 employees. It's a net assets total and a level of revenue which I don't actually have to hand, but it is very much set out in legislation. The rules are revised every few years to take into consideration inflation. But what we actually find is in reality, 99% of companies that exist are classified as small, and the vast majority of them don't have to produce an income statement. And then you get into an interesting discussion as to, well, should football clubs be treated as a separate case? Yeah, will this be part of the licensing rules of the regulator? I know some people are very adamant that that should be the case. Equally, I've spoken to club owners and say, well, we're effectively subsidising the club. Why should we produce additional information? And then it comes down to, again, why have a regulator in the first place? It's because football, in my view, is a unique bond between town and community, which doesn't arise in any other industry. If I said before, if my local garage goes bust, I'm sorry. I might know the guy that owns the garage. If a local supermarket closes down or a local factory, you're sorry because people are losing their jobs. For football, it is different because it's that lifelong bond.
Yeah, we started the show, Kieran, by talking about balls, and here we are, question three, talking balls again. Kieran, it's been an accusation that's thrown at us before, but we are genuinely talking balls, thanks to a question from Callum Burdick. And Callum Burdick specifically is asking about Premier League balls, Kieran, and says, as Nike brings out a set of new three Premier League footballs each year, what kind of cost does this incur on the club, which has to have tens or hundreds of each ball to train with each week? Is this a case of balls being supplied by the Premier League, or do each club choose how many they want and pay for them individually and then buy more when they get kicked over the hedge? I don't think it happens a lot, Premier League clubs. Also, what happens to these defunct balls at the end of the season or their usage periods? I think that's a question that the Baroness and Ali would like to ask. What happens to the defunct balls when their time is up. And we have talked about this before, Kieran, but I think, again, it's one of those questions that football fans are always interested in, which is why I'm always happy to revisit the economics of balls.
Yes, yes. And if your balls are feeling a bit defunct, why not use Manscaped 4.0?
Good work.
And there we are, free plug from one of our favourite sponsors.
Good work.
Right, well, I've done a bit of nerdling around, and it would appear that in the Premier League, the Premier League have a deal with Nike. And we've always had this thing at the World Cup, haven't we? That the ball's slightly different from the last one, and it swerves a bit more, yeah, and it's more difficult to control. And you always get these accusations. You go, well, it can't be that much rounder than 4 years ago. But Nike, by all accounts, they supply each club with 120 match quality balls. Now, the match quality balls are the ones which retail at 125 quid each.
Right.
In addition, they'll supply them with training balls, which are a lot cheaper. And I believe that this is where it does get quite intriguing. The club effectively orders 3 sets of balls. But remember, there's a summer ball and there's a winter ball with different colorways and so on. So the clubs decide how much of each type of ball they're going to order. And if they want to buy any extra, then they have to pay. I would imagine, therefore, that the sort of the ball monitor is an important person, because you don't want tens of these going missing on a regular basis. This is the type of thing. You can imagine if Uncle Terry was a ball monitor, he'd be nicking the real ones and replacing them with ones he used to get at Woolworths, which weren't necessarily match quality. In the EFL, intriguingly enough, you seem to get 125 balls. And initially, I thought, well, this is a bit strange. And the EFL deal, I think, is with Puma. And it used to be with Mitre all the time, but I think Puma have taken it over. And then I thought, well, hold on. In the EFL, you're playing 46 matches a season as opposed to 38 in the Premier League. So therefore, you've got 23 home games as opposed to 19. If you want to buy an extra ball in the EFL, apparently it will cost you £55. And what happens to them at the end of the season is that they're effectively recycled within the club, because they will then be passed down to the academy and they'll be used. This year's balls becomes next year's academy balls. And then the year after, the academy will pass them down to the youth team and so on. So they aren't thrown away, but they do have a limited life, because what we used to do at Sunday League football is that we used to caress them. Professional footballers hit a football very hard, and they do actually wear out. Yeah, they do actually sort of have a limited life, but they are used effectively until their end of their useful life.
Right. If you think for a second, Kieran, I'm going to pick up on the fact you said you used to caress your balls. You've got another thing coming. I think Uncle Terry would welcome a job as ball monitor, because I understand normally he gets put in the kitchens, doesn't he?
Yes.
Richard Wharton clearly is a caring sort of man. Mm. Richard says, and again, this is a subject we have talked about, Kieran, but it's one that doesn't go away. So again, I'm happy to revisit. But Richard Wharton says, I'm not a Wolves fan, but living close to Wolverhampton, I see lots of chatter from them on social media. I see quite a lot of chat from Wolves fans. I live miles away, Richard. That's how social media works. But Richard's picked up again about disquiet regarding the owners, Fosun. And Richard says, it's been apparent to me for a while that Wolves' inactivity in the transfer market was potentially linked to Fosun's poor investments and heavy debt interest repayments. But can you perhaps help unpick this a bit for the average supporter, please? And we do get asked a lot about concerned Wolves fans about what the owners' intentions are here in carrying on here, especially with the sort of uncertainty about whether China wants their businesses to continue investing in English football.
Yes. When Fosun first acquired Wolves, it was at a different point in terms of the attitude of the Chinese Communist Party to football. It used to be very expansive. There was a lot of Chinese investment, and also the Chinese Super League was one which, three or four years ago, it I remember one window where it spent more than the Premier League.
Yeah.
And then it all went very quiet. And what we've seen is I think the Chinese Communist Party felt uncomfortable with what they saw as conspicuous spending. They felt that was inconsistent with the way that they want to be represented. So one of the things that they introduced was a super tax. And therefore, when you signed a footballer from Europe, I think you had to pay 100% on top of the transfer fee as a tariff, which meant that that money dried up. The clubs themselves, many of which were effectively factory clubs, in the sense that they were owned by other industries, other institutions, they were not making money. Because there's a huge amount of interest in the Premier League and in particular, but also other parts of European football. So trying to get the crowds, they thought if we get the players over, then the crowds will flock, and that didn't quite materialise. And we have seen a sort of a slow withdrawal of Chinese investment. Now, in the case of Fosun, initially, when they acquired Wolverhampton Wanderers, they've got quite a close relationship with a well-known agent, yeah, who's just a pal, by the way. Apparently, but he has been very good at bringing players, especially Portuguese players, to Wolverhampton Wanderers, and Fosun were willing to underwrite the costs of running the club, and Wolves lost quite a bit of money in getting to the Premier League, and they didn't actually make a lot when they first arrived either. Fosun's loans maxed out at £126 million. And what they did in 2021 was they said, from what I read it, is right, we're going to write off those loans. Okay, we're not going to ask for the money back. They didn't even convert them to shares. They just said, no, we ain't going to have the money back. But then I certainly picked up the vibe we ain't going to put any more money into the club. It's effectively, that's your limit. And what we've seen Wolves do subsequently is that therefore they've had to borrow from financial institutions. So they've presently, in the most recent accounts, which are 2021, so we were expecting an update, hopefully in the next 6 weeks or so, they've borrowed £60 million. They're paying interest at over 7%. So they're paying £4 million a year in interest on these loans. That's a player and a half's wages.
Yeah.
So it is substantial. And the other thing that I've noticed, and in respect to Richard's comments that, Wolves seem to be much more cautious in the transfer window. Although I think they did break their transfer record in January. One area I always stick my nose into is, one reason why you're not spending money is because you already owe people a lot of money. And in the case of Wolves, they've got £110 million worth of transfer fees in installments unpaid.
Whoa.
As far as summer 21 was concerned. So it's a bit like having a credit card. If you're thinking you're spending on your credit card and you see, oh, Jesus Christ, this is how much you already owe, then you're probably inclined to think, I need to focus on getting that balance down to something a bit more reasonable before I start splurging again. So that appears to be the case as far as Wolves are concerned. I think perhaps some fans got quite excited when Fosun's originally arrived and they did splash the cash, and therefore that set a benchmark. That created an expectation amongst fans that level of spending would carry on ad infinitum, and that's proven not to be the case, because I think Fosun's circumstances as an institution have deteriorated. Certainly in COVID they were hit quite badly. The way that the Chinese economy is operating is different. They've been far more cautious in the COVID sort of environment than we have here in the UK, for example. And Fosun have been hit, and therefore they say, well, let's look at our portfolio of investments. And, well, you know, Wolves is one area where we can cut back, and therefore we think we shouldn't be putting more money into the club.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Thomas Butcher has our next question, Kieran, and Thomas is a Manchester City fan, so I'm going to really annoy him by taking that opportunity to congratulate Manchester United on winning the Carabao Cup this afternoon. Thomas Butcher is a Man City fan who lives in Berlin and says that I often find myself watching videos from the official Manchester City YouTube channel to get information about the club. However sanitised his content may be, it helps make up for the lack of English language football programming here in Germany. We happen to have a friend of Ali's around this afternoon who is a German football fan, who was less than impressed when I pointed this out to her. And she said, because what Thomas could do is learn bloody German then, basically.
Yes.
Because she says, oddly enough, there's not that much German language football programming over here. But nevertheless, taking that aside, Thomas has a good question. Thomas says, seeing that many of the videos have over 1 million views, I wonder whether the revenue generated by clubs from YouTube make the channels and their media output in general self-sustaining. And more importantly, could it be possible that clubs actually make enough significant profit for these channels to reinvest into the team?
I think where we are presently, Thomas, is we've still got some way to go. YouTube, and I look at a load of stuff on YouTube. The royalties you get on YouTube from each viewing are actually very, very small. And also, if you talk to performing artists in the music industry in relation to Spotify,
yeah, the
number of times you have to be downloaded before you get, say, 100 quid is frankly ridiculous. So I don't think it's particularly lucrative. I appreciate as a Manchester City fan, the last club you want reference to is Manchester United. But if we take a look at Manchester United and MUTV, Manchester United is a big brand. It is a big global brand. It makes £7 million a year from MUTV, which is not a lot of money. And in fact, it loses money. It does various bits and pieces of swapping in order to break even on an accounting basis, but it appears that it's losing quite a substantial amount of money each year before various recharges. So if Manchester United can only make £7 million a year, and to put that in context, a good match at Old Trafford, I think I would imagine that when they played Barcelona on Thursday night, they would have probably got the thick end of £6 million from match day tickets alone.
Yeah.
And here you've got MUTV generating £7 million for a year. Mm. So by Manchester United standards, it's probably bringing in 1-1.5% of total revenue. Not to be sneezed at, provided you're turning that into a profit. But all of the football clubs are trying to unlock the Pandora's box of some form of engagement, be it audiovisual, be it augmented reality, being it virtual reality. And the reason why the Glazers appear to be getting cold feet to a certain extent with regard to the sale of the club is that the offers that have come in to date have been in the region of around about $4.5 billion. From what I understand, they think it's worth considerably more because they do believe, effectively going back to Thomas's original point, and this is something which I think – let's make reference to City. When City Football Group sold 15% of the club, which I think is now 17%, to Silver Lake, that was on the basis that all the parties believe that somehow football clubs are going to start to extract a lot more money, especially from overseas fans. But that's not yet happened. And it's the same with the Glazers. They're convinced that in 5 years' time, we'll all be right out wandering, you know, in Nairobi, in Sydney, in Delhi, wherever it's going to be. People will be wandering around it with virtual reality goggles, watching an experience from Old Trafford when a match is taking place, and be willing to pay money for the privilege. But we're not quite there yet.
I believe, Kieran, off the top of my head, that it was Man City were the first team to announce that they were going to have a stadium in the metaverse, I believe. Were they not? We discussed that.
That's right. Yes, they did that with Sony. That was probably about 6 to 8 months ago. And since then, it's all gone a bit quiet, as have many things in relation to the metaverse. It's quite a nice, sexy, abstract concept. I know that the traditional broadcasters are fully aware of it, and they are doing what they can. But it's not going to be easy to get people to spend more money on watching TV at home. On watching football at home. But they're, and you know, some of the initiatives which Sky have taken historically. Remember they introduced 3D TV, and I had one of those 3D TVs with goggles, and it just didn't work. It just spooked me out, and you spend more time sort of looking at your hand, bringing your hand closer and further away from you. You go, wow, that's really spooky. And you go, hold on, I see in 3D. Anyway, my hand. Why am I trying to do this with a pair of goggles on? So the technology is not there yet, Thomas, in order to really make money. But that is certainly an area that football clubs are keen to adopt, because sport going forwards is probably going to be the only communal watching of broadcast media that is going to generate huge numbers, with the exception, I think, of some legacy shows such as Strictly, which are quite family orientated.
It's also the 3D cameras that we used during that experiment were huge. I mean, they were the size of a small car, and it doesn't take a lot to make a cameraman moan. It takes even less to make a sound man moment. The cameraman really didn't like these 3D cameras. You mentioned Barcelona, Kieran. I meant to ask you this after we interviewed Tracy Crouch from earlier. Their defeat against Man United, which means they're not in the last 16 of the Europa League, we discussed at some length earlier, late last year. They've essentially mortgaged their future broadcasting rights for the next 25 odd years. So not getting into the Europa League is not a good start to that arrangement, is it?
It's not, yes. Expect one or two sales this summer, right. I would surmise. Tebas and La Liga. Tebas can be a complete pain in the backside with some of his rants, but the cost control rules that they have in La Liga are pretty strict. And, yeah, Barcelona will be smarting as a result of that. They did recruit players over the course of last summer, and they've not delivered the return on investment in terms of progress in European football. And, yeah, if Manchester United can make 5 or 6 million from a home game in a Europa League match, well, I can assure you Barcelona can do the same. Yeah. So it is going to be it is going to have an impact upon their budget for next season.
Yeah, and they've got to knock an eye-opening amount of money off their wage bill, haven't they, in the summer?
Yes, yeah, and they sign players as if they were living in La La Land last summer, and I think that's going to come home. But I suspect we'll be seeing more economic levers being sprung out like a magician's rabbit over the course of the summer. And remember, economic levers is Barcelona speak for payday loans.
Yes. don't mention La La Land, Kieran. It's one of the few things that Ali and I disagree on. I think it's a really good film, but I thought the ending was terrible. It demanded a happy ending, whereas Ali said, life's not happy, bad things happen. She said it in a rather personal way, I thought, but there you are. Will Greave is a Reading fan, and Will says that his club, Reading, always seem to be one of the last teams in the country each season to release their kit. Now, rumours around the fan base always seem to be that the earlier you release your kit in the summer, the more you pay, and that the club do not believe they'll make up the cost of releasing the kits earlier with sales. Is this true? I'm sorry if that sounded like I was laughing, Daniel. I was just laughing at the concept of, I just love fan-based rumours. I just love the way well, you know what that is, don't you? I know it's not a Reading accent. It's a very difficult accent to do, a Reading accent. But I love the fact that they're sitting in the pub and going, of course, you can't release it early. We can't afford it. Is it true, Kieran?
I don't think there is any credence to that, I'm afraid, Will. I did do some research on this. Reading's kit was available in the club shop the day before the season started, which is pretty poor, I'll be honest. There are supply chain issues affecting many industries, as we know as well, given that we are going to become turnip experts, I think, in this country for the next 6 weeks, judging from what's happening at Waitrose. And Reading's third kit wasn't launched until September the 29th. And I'm going, I think they've missed a trick there. So this is all to do with supply chain issues. And I think looks as if Reading switched to Macron for 22-23. Macron, an Italian manufacturer, made good kits. Yeah, no issue with that. It was the first season. But what the football clubs will do in terms of their relationship with the manufacturers is ultimately the manufacturers don't care what the club is. They do care about how quickly the shirts will sell. Now, if you've got a limited number of factories and you've got one or two clubs where you can guarantee 100,000 units in the case of Manchester United, Chelsea, Liverpool, Manchester City, Spurs, we know the big clubs and we know who they are. That's where the manufacturers will focus their attention. And the other clubs become an afterthought. You know, if Manchester United want to sell more kits, Adidas will arrange that very, very quickly. I cannot buy a Brighton kit. And we're only in January, February. They've sold out, and it looks as if they're not going to get any more because we had a huge surge in kit sales pre-Christmas due to Mitoma, and there was huge numbers of Japanese fans coming just to see him and buying the merchandise. So now from what I'm hearing, and I may be wrong because I've got no channels here to the club, is tough. Nike aren't going to supply any more kits to Brighton because they're simply not big enough a club as far as Nike are concerned, and the focus will be on Chelsea and Liverpool and PSG and so on. And I get that because they will be saying, when we want to order more, we need another 50,000 units, and Brighton might be saying, can you get another 2,000? It's simply not worth changing a production schedule for the small volume. And therefore, in the case of Reading, unfortunately, you're not very high up their pecking order when it comes to that relationship with Macron. It doesn't mean that you're any less deserving as individual fans, but this is business, and they much prefer long production runs with high volumes of units because they know that they'll sell instantly. Whereas it will take for a smaller club such as Reading, it takes longer to sell the units, and it simply means a slower process, which is frustrating from a fan point of view.
These must be distressing times for you Brighton fans, Kieran. Not only have Waitrose run out of fancy lettuce and heritage tomatoes, they've run out of Brighton shirts as well.
Yes.
That's terrible. I thought just yesterday morning, I thought Ed was being very patient when I explained to him that in my day, you got tomatoes in the summer because that's when they grew. He didn't get tomatoes in the winter. It turned out he had his headphones on. So... that's what happened. You had tomatoes for about 2 weeks. We didn't have such a thing as seasonal cooking in South London, Kieran, as you say. But my mum's only concession to seasonal cooking was that on the 1st of July, she took the ketchup off the table and put salad cream on it. On the 15th of July, the salad cream went off and the tomato ketchup went back. It was the happiest day of the year, basically. It's Christmas, the day the clocks went back, and the day the salad cream disappeared back into its cupboard. Dan Walls has a question that occupies a lot of football fans, Kieran. This is one of those top five questions that I get asked in pubs, certainly. Mm. And that is, can you tell me how a compensation fee is calculated for players in youth academies? Is it a standard fee calculated on the number of years that the player is in the academy? Does the category of the academy have any influence? And does the team losing the player get any say in the figure?
Right, Dan. This is determined by the Elite Player Performance Plan. Now, the Elite Player Performance Plan does have some positives in terms of the potential quality of the care that you get. It also has some pretty big negatives because this was introduced by the Premier League to clubs in the EFL as a strong arm tactic a few years ago. And effectively, the Premier League had been saying for a few years, we will give you what's referred to as solidarity payments. We will actually give you a share of the Premier League TV money. And the EFL, A, said thank you very much, and B, became quite addicted to it. And then the Premier League says, we said we'd give you some of these solidarity payments, but we've not committed to paying them going forwards, unless you sign up to the Elite Player Performance Plan. So this was very much a vehicle, and as a negotiating tactic, quite a Machiavellian one. You know, give some people some money, get them addicted to the product, and then start to negotiate some concessions on the back of that. So we now do have very much a fixed tariff. If you've had somebody in your academy between the years of 9 and 11, and this is regardless of the academy level, you would get £3,000 for each year. So this effectively means that if, let's say that you're, you know, you're Oxford United or you're Exeter or you're Morecambe, and you've had a kid and they've been at the academy for a year and they've done really well, a Premier League club can come along and say, oh, God, that kid looks really promising. Here's £3,000 and 24 hours later, the kid disappears. Now, part of me thinks, we're dealing with children here. And I am, as somebody that works in education, and the Baroness has worked in education, she is very protective of children and also equally concerned about how some parents view their children as monetized beings or potentially monetized beings. When you get to the age of 12, the amount of compensation you get is per year between £12,500 and £40,000. And that does vary according to the level of the academy. So there is a fixed fee, and you can therefore work out that would be. Now, should that young person go on to make first team appearances, if they are playing in the Premier League, it effectively works out as £15,000 per appearance up to the first 100 appearances. And I think it effectively tapers off as you get sort of 80, 90, 100. So I think you can get up to £1.3 million on top of whatever you would have earned from them coming from the academy. If they get as far as the championship, it's not £15,000 per appearance. It works out broadly as around about £2,500 per appearance. But once again, once they get to 100 appearances, that's it. That's where the agreement stops. So, the Premier League clubs can therefore pick up these kids very, very cheaply. If you end up getting somebody and they've cost you, 1.3, £1.5 million, and they go on to be a successful Premier League player, then the Exeter or the Morecambe or the Accrington probably hasn't got a very good compensation as a result of it. And we have seen quite a few clubs, therefore, either downgrade their academies because they think, well, you know, what's the point?
Yeah.
Yeah, if we do our job well and we produce some talented kids, they're going to be picked off by the vultures for effectively nothing. So they've either downgraded them or they've just said, we're not going to run academies. I know Brentford have got a B team model. I think Birmingham have done similar. I think Huddersfield have considered it, though some of them might be having second thoughts about getting rid of the academies altogether. So it's a bit of a sorry tale. There are some positives about EPPP. I'm not denying that. But the motivations behind it were purely monetary. And as Gary Neville often says, if something looks a bit strange in football, it's all to do with money.
Yeah. The Premier League clubs cannot lose, really, Kieran, can they? In the unlikely event that a good player slips through their scouting system, they just pay peanuts to pick him up from whoever did find him. Our penultimate question, Kieran, comes from Ross Jones. And Ross says, I know you've discussed the multi-fan ownership model in the past, but I've noticed a new version of this called New Fan, N-U-F-A-N. They discuss fans voting to buy a club and a shirt colour, etc. There's limited information on their website, and they seem to be at an early stage, but they're offering various subscription packages ranging from £4 to £9 per month. Does this seem legit? It doesn't sound it, Kieran, I have to say.
How do you define legit? I think would be the start point.
Uncle Terry would be proud of you there, Kieran. the acorn hasn't fallen far from the tree there, has it?
Right, let's take a look at Newfan. So this is a company which was formed in November 22. It consists of people, I think there's four shareholders of the company called Newfan Limited. But they have also set up a football club called AFC Crewe, which plays in the Crewe and District League. Now, that's level 14. There's nothing wrong with that. It's Parks football. Yeah. Okay, nothing wrong with that whatsoever. They are currently top of the league. They're absolutely smashing it. But what are you getting for your £4 or £9 per month? If you're paying £4 a month, I like the fact that you can't have more. You get a share for your £4 per month, and no one person can have more than one share, so therefore they can't be bought out. You can't sell the shares, which seems to be a bit of a downturn. And if you do buy your share, it means that you're a board member, which potentially could mean you get an awful lot of people who call themselves board members. If you pay the £9 per month, you appear to get exactly the same. You seem to get exactly the same benefits, except you get a framed certificate of your share, which to me seems quite a lot of additional money for relatively little benefit. And if you stop your subscription, you lose your right to be a shareholder or a board member. So it's an interesting concept. In terms of getting a financial return on your investment, I'm a little bit sceptical. And for that read, I think you're going to get very little out of it whatsoever. It's an idea. What's going to happen to that £3.99 per month? I don't know. The people involved say, we're fed up of the corruption in football. We're fed up of oligarchs and hedge funds and so on. This is going to be fan owned, and to be fair, it is fan owned. But £8.99 per month. Yeah, that's the thick end of what I pay for my TV license, and I get more than a chance to go and get streaming of a football match in a Crewe park once a fortnight. So it seems a little bit pricey in terms of what you're getting. The people might say the same about Patreon and the price of football. That's although true. We are available for as little as £1 a month.
We are.
And for that you get our eternal good thanks.
Yeah.
So it's not a scam from what I can see. It seems to be well meaning. But I would like a little bit more in the form of governance and transparency as to what's happening with that money. You know, how is it being utilized? It's either, you know, £48 a year or, you know, what, 912? So it's £108 a year for a football club that is playing in the in Parks Footballing Crewe, and therefore it's probably got realistically, you know, what, 12, 15 home games a season. You know, that does seem quite expensive.
Yeah, and that £5 a month extra seems to be quite a lot for a frame, essentially.
Yes.
That's all you're getting.
Yes.
I should point out, Kieran, we at the Price of Football are available for nothing.
Absolutely.
It's only Patreon that you have to pay for. Like you say, it's only a quid. Our final question, Kieran, comes from Tom Foy. And it's a cracking question, Kieran. Proper existential question / pointless pub conversation. This is the sort of conversation that football fans would love to have all around the country at any stage of the season. And you can't answer it. I think, well, you can answer it, but I think actually I'm going to suggest that some football fans stop listening at this point, because then it will take the fun out of the question. Because Tom says, is it more expensive to be a football fan now than in the noughties, the 90s, the 80s or the 70s? So is the price of a match day pie program ticket, etc., more expensive now when you take into account inflation and how it correlates with average disposable income at the time?
Yes, it is more expensive to be a football fan. What I did is I went back to 1980-81, and the reason why I did that, because that's when I started at the University of Manchester, and I used to regularly go to both Old Trafford and Main Road. Yeah. Because, and then on a Friday night, I'd go to, you know, Rochdale or Stockport or Tranmere, and then I wondered why I never had any friends at university. It's because I spent all my time either going to football grounds in the northwest of England, or watching obscure indie bands. But the reason I was able to do that was watching football was cheap. You could, in 1980-81, I could go to Old Trafford and watch a match in the Stretford End for £1.50, or I could go and watch a match in the Kippax, and I think it cost me £1.30. If you wanted to sit, it would cost you £2. Now, if we then apply inflation since then, since 1980, inflation works out as 603%. So therefore, if I wanted to sit, it would cost me, at a comparative level, £12.06 to sit in a seat at Old Trafford. Now, you know, we know that subsequently we've had the Taylor Report, and all grounds are sitting. But looking at Manchester United now, You can't buy a. I used to go and, Saturday morning, wake up, what should I do today? I'll go and watch United or go and watch City. But if I didn't have any assignments or you know, sort of stuff to do, and you just turn up and you pay your money over through the turnstiles. Now you can't do that. I mean, you know, to be fair, you know, the Premier League is fantastically successful, and therefore you have to book your tickets in advance. But if you want a ticket at Manchester United, you need to be a member. That membership realistically is probably going to cost you £35. And then if you do want a seat, I looked at United's website today. You know, clearly, the remainder of the season is practically sold out, apart from hospitality packages at eye-watering numbers. But you know, a decent seat would cost you in the region of £58, from what I can make out here. So considerably higher than the £12.06 that you would pay in terms of inflation. With regards to catering prices, they've gone up broadly in line with inflation. You know, I don't think you get particularly ripped off at football grounds any more than you used to. You know, and you and I, we can both remember going to the cinema when we were kids, and you know, it was eye watering for packet of Spangles. In those days, and it's, you know, if you go today, you'll pay over the odds, but cinemas have always done that, and football grounds have always been a bit of a premium price compared to where you can get food and drink locally.
Yeah, talking of football in the old days, Kieran, we'd obviously like to recognise and mourn the passing of John Motson, who was the voice of football for many of us in the old days. It's a cliche, I know, but he was very supportive to me when I started my career at Match of the Day 2. Very helpful. He was also a very good man to go out for a drink with, because you never bought a pint. He would simply stand at the bar, raise his voice a little, and the whole pub would go, "Ah, John Motson, what would you like to drink?" And he'd say, well, there's a few of us, lads. That's fine. It's great. So the game will be less rich without him, to be honest.
Absolutely.
So we send our condolences to his family and friends and all his old colleagues. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, as Kieran mentioned slightly earlier, you can do that by going to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. We will be back on Thursday for our news pod, which may, Kieran, you never know, lead to us speculating how much Graham Potter's getting paid off for. In the meantime, I shall hand you over. I nearly forgot your name there, Kieran. That's terrible, isn't it? It's because we did so many pods last week. I've barely mentioned it. I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran McGuire for his customary farewell.
Well, thank you for all the support. It has been a busy week at Price of Football Towers, and if it wasn't for the groovy vibes that we get from you, we wouldn't do it, because I don't think I've ever been closer to divorce with the Baroness than I have this week, to be perfectly frank with you. Four Price of Football shows, two with Theo Delaney on Life Goals, and a lot of media stuff in relation to the white paper. Getting those warm vibes is really kind, and also some of the very kind words that people have said with regards to us going through 7 million downloads, which is still baffled by, but we take it all the same. There's other ways in which you can support the club, and you can show us a bit of positives, and that's to go on to your app through which you download the show and leave a review, because according to Producer Guy, it helps in terms of we're often asking guests, and that's one of the first things they tend to do, and especially if the reviews are relatively up to date, that helps, and it improves the algorithm according to Producer Guy, but apparently it doesn't really matter what you say, so you could even say you would rather have the show presented by Bez from the Happy Mondays and My Uncle Terry, and it wouldn't make a blind bit of difference to us in terms of the ratings. And I can assure you, I would listen to that show with mouth agape.
Do you know, I've got a feeling your Uncle Terry would probably get on quite well with Bez.
I think he would, yes.
You know, you mentioned that you didn't have a lot of friends when you were younger, Kieran. It's possibly because you use phrases like groovy vibes. That might not have helped. Plus, and also, we're not in the business of promoting other podcasts here, Kieran, but that Theo Delaney pod is a cracker.
It is.
It's a really, really good listen, that Theo Delaney pod. So I would recommend that to anybody with a love of football and indeed a love of music, which I'm sure is one of the two reasons why you enjoy doing it so much, Kieran.
Yes. Yeah. It's like Desert Island Discs for football fans.
Yes.
And I spent hours and hours agonizing, because you are limited in the number. I think there's 8 goals, including the goal that you hate, and I think you can probably guess the goal that I hate the most from the night of shame at the Amex. It was wonderful, and Theo is also an absolutely splendid chap.
Yeah, it is. I found it. I reckon it took me to the first 5 bits of music and the first 5 goals easy. Then after that, it's really difficult. Struggle, because there's so many. It's a great pod. Do listen to it. Bye, everybody.
Bye. The Price of Football. Price of Football.